Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 97, recorded Saturday, March 3rd, 2012. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: first trip to Beijing, and most important, hotel technology. Well, bless me, sinners, for I have sinned. It has been 8 weeks since my last podcast. What would be the appropriate penance? I don't know, two Our Fathers, three Hail Marys, sitting next to a mother and a lap child on next Tuesday's 3.5-hour flight to Phoenix, maybe giving up snarky TSA tweets for Lent. That would be a harsh set of penance, especially the TSA thing. I just have been doing quite a bit of travel since the last episode in January. 10 days in Beijing, 3 days in London, 2 days in Vienna, a week in Phoenix, and the back end of the week before last in New York. I hung out in Chicago the prior week, and then down to New Orleans this week. Coming up March this month has me back in Phoenix next week, then out to Brussels, then back in New York, and then down to San Juan, Puerto Rico for spring break with the family. I'll tell you, in the first quarter of this year, the first quarter, first 3 months of 2012, I will have traveled 11 out of 13 weeks. That's probably my most intense run since about 3 or 4 years ago, when I traveled every week from the beginning of September, Labor Day, until Christmas week. And so you look at it, it's a pretty interesting mix of travel destinations, and it's allowed me to do quite a bit of comparison. I mean, the domestic flights have been jam-packed as usual, while the international flights have been surprisingly open. My trip over to Beijing last month, business class was only half full, and coach even less than that. I had the two-side window aisle seat of a United 777 to myself on the way over. I mean, it was nice. It was one of those upgraded 777s with lie-back seats or lie-flat seats and big 22-inch monitors. So I had both monitors displaying the flight map at sort of different levels of zoom as we went straight north from Chicago. I saw a lot of frozen Ontario. Now, the flight back from Vienna by way of London, I didn't upgrade to business. I didn't need the sleep. I had my iPad fully charged and loaded with content, so coach was fine. And it's interesting, business was full, but coach was like two-thirds empty. I ended up actually with more room in coach than I would have had in business. I mean, you know, further on back, people were sacked out across the middle row. I had a two-side again to myself, so I spread out, did a little work, and then mucked around with my iPad. It was a rude crash to earth, though, on my flight in and out of LaGuardia. Now, I'm 1K on United, but was 15th in line for the one remaining upgrade. Heck, I felt lucky to get an exit row middle seat. I think even the lap kids on that flight had status. So following up, in the last episode, I talked about the Jawbone Jambox wireless speaker I got for Christmas. It got a good bit of use in my Beijing hotel room. I was there for 8 days. The room only had two English language TV stations, CNN and BBC World News. I mean, you can only watch that 30-minute news roll just so many times. So I powered through most of my podcast backlog, a few new albums, a couple of documentaries I'd loaded up before heading over. You know, good quality sound on the Jambox, and I'll tell you, much less awkward than sitting around the room wearing my Bose headphones. Now, in past episodes, I've talked about the slum terminals in big airports, the terminal where the non-hub airlines have their couple of gates. I mean, at O'Hare, United has Terminal 1, American Terminal 3, separated by Terminal 2, the slum terminal, where US Air, Delta, and JetBlue all live. In Phoenix, US Air and Southwest split the renovated sort of shopping mall-like Terminal 4, which is really nice, while everyone else slums it out in Terminals 2 and 3. Now, when I fly home from Europe on U.S. carriers, I feel a bit of the same sort of slum treatment. For what I'm sure are security reasons, the U.S. carrier gates are all, I mean, they all seem to be inconveniently located at the end of the longest concourse where there are no services, no restaurants, no shops, no bars. I mean, heck, it's often a hunt for a restroom. At Heathrow Terminal 2, they tell you it's a 20-minute walk from security to these gates. I mean, you know, no dawdling and duty-free. In Beijing, though, it was a very different story. The United flights to O'Hare, San Francisco, and Washington Dulles Airport all left from gates conveniently located in the center of the concourse, sort of just a 5-minute walk at most from the restaurants and shops. Nor was there the extra security screening at the gate you typically go through in European airports. I just walked out of the bar and right onto the plane. In Vienna, I experienced kind of a different twist. Now, I was flying to Heathrow on BMI, the former British Midlands, but somehow ended up in what seemed to be a slum satellite terminal entirely devoted to Russian flights. I mean, it was once again at the end of the terminal and down a set of stairs, complete with a smoking room the size of 4 phone booths, in which at one point I counted 7 guys. I mean, it was the only smoking room I saw in the entire Vienna airport, and it's maybe the reason it and its Russian clientele got stuffed in the slum terminal, but I don't know, that doesn't explain why my Heathrow flight ended up there, unless BMI got, I don't know, a smoking deal on the gate fees. You know, we've had kind of a discussion thread across a few episodes on the TSA's global entry program, Pay $100, which actually many travel companies like American Express are reimbursing for their top-tier customers. So you pay the money, you give the TSA your life story and a set of fingerprints, and you get to skip the U.S. immigration lines for a set of kiosks over in the corner. I mean, it's been a huge time saver for me and a number of Travel Commons listeners. So imagine my surprise returning to Chicago from Vienna by way of Heathrow. I see, you know, like 5 to 10 people queued for the global entry kiosks and nobody waiting for a live immigration agent. Now, I'd filled out the customs card on the flight, so I just walked up to the agent. He processed me, but then he saw the, you know, the global entry sticker on the back of my passport and asked why I didn't use the kiosk. I just pointed over to the line. He looked. He said, yeah, you knew that was going to happen eventually. Now, I kind of posted this comment on the Travel Commons Facebook wall, and Bob Fennerty commented. He said, you know, maybe the model will flip one day. Global entry will be free, and instead of paying to use the kiosk, you'll pay to be processed by an agent. Bob says, I always fill out the customs card on the plane so I can choose to use global entry or not. I probably skip the kiosks every 5th or 6th arrival. Now, and okay, so if I can slip one last TSA comment before I try and give it up for Lent. I mean, what's with the incredible waste of machinery at most TSA checkpoints? I mean, on the last trip out of Phoenix, the TSA lines were 15 minutes long, while 4 of the 6 lanes of screening equipment sat idle. I mean, the same thing in O'Hare a couple of weeks ago, a 15-minute wait in the status line while 4 lanes of adjacent equipment were closed off, unmanned behind sort of a gated door. The problem? Well, I mean, it's the full-body scanners. Not only does the full-body scanner take longer, I mean, instead of the second or two it takes you to walk through the metal detector, you have to stand with your arms raised for 5 to 7 seconds, then wait another 5 to 10 seconds for the remote screener to radio the okay to the gatekeeper, who then opens the gate to let you out. So, you know, sort of 10 to 20 seconds per person instead of the 1 to 2 seconds it takes for a walk-through metal detector. I mean, that math isn't exactly difficult. But then you add to that the additional staff the body scanner requires, the remote screener, the gatekeeper, the one at the front keeping everybody queued, and you can see the double effect. Not only does the body scanner slow down the 2 lanes running through it, it also consumes staff that might be manning 1 or 2 of those other idle lanes. I mean, I'll tell you, I don't think a little more efficiency or a little less line time is too much to ask from an agency that spent over $8 billion last year. Hey, and if you've got a comment, a question, a story, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like virtual recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an audio comment. Or, you know, you can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can sort of post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or, as always, you can post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is first trip to Beijing. Now, my first trip of this year, first trip of 2012, was a big one, from Chicago to Beijing, just short of 14 hours each way on United's direct Chicago to Beijing flight. I mean, the timing on the flight over was a bit goofy. I left at noon on Tuesday and landed in Beijing around 4:30 Wednesday afternoon. I mean, I kind of had a hard time figuring out when I was supposed to sleep. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, the flight was a polar route straight north from Chicago over Ontario, Alaska, and then down over Siberia. I did manage to take an afternoon nap, but sort of pretty much putzed around for 14 hours. I mean, I looked out the window a lot after we crossed the Arctic Circle. I was kind of hoping to see some northern lights, but no luck on that. Did some work, listened to some podcasts, watched a couple of episodes of a BBC documentary on the history of Beijing that had ripped down to my iPad. But after sort of 14 hours in a dry metal tube, it actually was very refreshing to walk out into a spacious, modern, clean airport. And it's kind of as you would expect, since the international terminal in Beijing, Terminal 3, opened right before the 2008 Summer Olympics. So, you know, do the math. It's less than 4 years old. And it is big. I guess, according to Wikipedia, more space than all five of London Heathrow's terminals combined. And this was kind of an underlying observation during the whole trip. You know, with more than 1.3 billion people, a lot of things just have to be big in China. Now, I kind of knew this intellectually before the trip, but it really didn't hit me until I was there. I mean, 20 million people in Beijing, and it's smaller than Shanghai. I mean, a local guy I was working with said that he was from a small town about an hour west of Beijing. And I just said, well, geez, I mean, how many people live in your town? I asked. And he said, about a million, he answered. And so a small town with a million people. And he wasn't joking. He kind of said that with a straight face. Now, the other thing I thought I was prepared for, but really wasn't, was the pollution. I mean, we all remember the warnings before the Summer Olympics about how the pollution was going to bring the marathoners to their knees, and then nothing really happened. Well, the day after we arrived, I mean, the first day of business, we walked out of the office building and down the block to a restaurant for lunch. I mean, halfway down the block, I could feel the itching in the back of my throat, and my eyes started burning, and then by the end of the day, I had a low-grade headache. And this was, you know, this was just the first day. Not that it got any better. I mean, we started joking that on a clear day you could see across the street. I mean, looking up in the sky, we had no problem looking directly into the sun. One guy got a nice photo of the sun with his iPhone. I mean, I was running a pollution headache about every other day, and I definitely, toward the end of that, was starting to look forward to my flight home. The food was very good, if you like Chinese food, which I do. I mean, we ate at a lot of different restaurants, all of it good, but at just about every meal, there was one dish that made you go, hmm. I mean, the first night we ate at the hotel, we had just arrived a couple hours earlier, we're a bit out of it from the time change and the long flight, and so we were just looking for beer and a bit of food, more kind of to keep us awake to try and adjust to the time zone more than any actual hunger. Now, the waitstaff didn't speak much English, but they did have a picture menu, so it kind of helped us, you know, to do sort of the point-and-shoot method of ordering. You know, we'll take one of those, one of those, one of those, one of those, and four beers. So the waiter went away and then came back with a colleague, one who could speak a bit of English. "I'm sorry," she said, "but we're out of the pickled donkey meat appetizer you chose, but we can substitute the specially spiced donkey meat instead," and then walked off before we could say anything. And then brought back the specially spiced donkey meat. Nice sort of little kind of cubes that looked a little like spam. In the next couple of days, we learned that donkey meat is a Beijing specialty. Shanghai, no donkey meat. But Beijing, you can get donkey meat. So I guess we lucked out on our first meal. And it was always something. Like when they split the head of the Peking duck and served it on a plate so you could pick at the brains. Or when they gave me a cup of fish soup with kind of slimy water lily stems and a small albino fish staring up at me. Or at the hot pot restaurant where what I thought was brown tofu was actually some sort of pressed loaf of coagulated duck blood. And at just about every meal, there was a plate of jellyfish. But when I wanted to share pictures of this food with friends on Facebook, I ran smack up against the great firewall of China. You know, logged into the hotel's Wi-Fi, I could Skype back home, I could run email, I could do most everything except access Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. All blocked. Now, not with a big, you know, do not go here, turn back sort of error page. It was just like those sites don't exist. You put in the URL, you get a blank web page, and then you watch the browser churn and churn and churn and churn, waiting for a reply until either you give up and move on or the timer gives up and times out. Now, for me, it wasn't tough to get around. I just fired up our corporate sort of Cisco VPN client, nailed up a secure connection to our Scottsdale data center, and then bingo, I had a nice tunnel through the Great Firewall. I updated my Facebook and Twitter statuses, posted a picture of the albino fish soup to Facebook. I was social again. I was also able to download content in iTunes that had been unavailable before. I guess, I don't know, for copyright reasons, things like podcasts from the BBC, you know, coming onto the internet out of our, Arizona data center with a US IP address, everything was back to normal. Now, before I left, getting ready for the trip, I had been pleasantly surprised, actually, to find out that AT&T's international data plan included China. And, you know, in planning for this Beijing trip and then the European trip that I was going to take 2 weeks after that, I ended up buying sort of 125 meg sort of bucket of data for $50 just in case I needed it. Now, on the ground in Beijing, it was great. You know, I was using maps, trying to find my way around. 3G connectivity, no problem. Nailed up, full bars on the iPhone. But what really surprised me was that, actually, I was able to connect to Facebook and Twitter with my iPhone. I mean, for some reason, the Great Firewall didn't apply to mobile data. But, you know, even with my social networks reestablished, after 8 days in Beijing, I was out of eye drops and out of ibuprofen. I was kind of tired of jellyfish. And, you know, and actually the city started to empty out. All the Beijingers were heading back to their small towns of a million people and their villages for the, for the Chinese New Year, for the Lunar New Year, what they called the spring festivities, even though it was the end of January. And, you know, I kind of felt, it was, after 8 days, it was about right. All the Beijingers are heading home. It was time for me to head home, too. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, the most important hotel technology. Now, on my Beijing trip, I spent just short of 28 hours in United 777s, a little more than a day. I spent 8 days in my hotel, though, so no matter how good or bad the United flights were, it was going to be this hotel that was going to make or break the trip. Now, actually, it was a nice hotel. It was in the north part of the city, right up by the Olympic Village. I could see the Bird's Nest Stadium, where they did the opening and closing ceremonies. Saw that every night. It was kind of lit up in orange. It was really neat. To the extent that you could see it through the pollution fog. I ended up upgrading my room for, I don't know, maybe it was an extra 10 or 15 bucks a night, but it gave me a larger room with a nice sitting area, kind of a couch, a chair, a little coffee table. Although I guess China, I guess that would be a tea table. I mean, it was just nice to have that extra space so I wouldn't be, you know, sitting on my bed the whole time. And we've talked in past episodes about the importance of the hotel bathroom and how that is often overlooked. Not in this room, though. I mean, it was modern, clean, spacious, and most importantly, the shower had good water pressure. But as we've talked again before, a lot of sort of the noise and the press around hotels has been around new hotel technology. Now, La Quinta, a U.S. bargain chain, has recently been making noise. I saw a new TV ad campaign about their rollout of flat-screen high-def TVs, and they let you plug in your gaming or iDevices into them. And I mean, other higher-end hotels are loaning out iPads during your stay. I'll tell you, though, after 8 days in Beijing, I decided that the single most important technology, though, in my hotel room wasn't a flat-screen TV, nor was it my, Jawbone Jambox speaker that I really liked. It was actually the thermostat. For the first 5 days, everything worked fine. My room was a comfortable sort of 21 degrees Celsius, 71 degrees Fahrenheit. Then one night, my thermostat, decided I was too cold. And after a lousy night's sleep, I woke up to 25 degrees Celsius or 77 degrees Fahrenheit. I pushed every button on that thermostat, turned it off and on, kind of tried to reboot it, even downloaded the manual from the internet, actually read it, but no luck. And, of course, the hotel front desk and engineering staff, I mean, they weren't of much use either. They came up and pushed the same buttons I did and got the same result. Their suggestion, open a window, which actually would have been a very reasonable suggestion if the Beijing air wasn't so polluted. I mean, as it was, with the thermostat turned off, the outside air began to leak into the room. I could taste the pollution in my mouth when I walked in, every time I walked into my room. Maybe I'm a wimp, but after 3 days of this, I would have happily traded the flat-screen TV and its two English language channels for a working thermostat. I mean, if you think about it, it's pretty common sense. I mean, first and foremost, I want my room to be comfortable. I mean, it kind of goes back to Maslow's hierarchy. You have to meet my basic physiological needs. I mean, the right room temperature, which gets a good night's sleep, and then also a decent shower is important. But you got to meet those basic needs before I can begin to think about the self-actualizing potential of a half a dozen channels of high-def sports programming. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 97. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast and hope you all decide to stay subscribed. Indeed, hope you enjoyed it so much that you might even recommend it to a friend. The bridge music on today's show is from the PodSafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. The songs, in order of appearance, Wanna Love You by Anta Ellis, Snub-Nosed Aardvark by Derek K. Miller, and Baja Taxi by Brain Bucket. I always love it when I get those names. Hey, and remember, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, as always, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or you can always send them over to me at mpeacock on Twitter, or you can write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the Facebook wall or on the website. I really do appreciate it. And until we talk again, take care, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the one woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling,